institutions and organizations fall under American decision making and do not go beyond it. So even Western countries you mentioned, the Troika, like Germany, France, and the United Kingdom, they simply comply with American demands when requesting Iran to do illogical things that have no relation to the IAEA's mandates or obligations. You know, they have used this agency as a means, like you said, to spy on Iran, to provide information that the agency is supposed to preserve, yet it leaks this information to Israel. The information leaked to the entity contributed to the illegal strike on Iran last June, including the assassination of scientists, and the IAEA will continue to give intelligence information to the West. So this won't change, and Iran, of course, is aware of this. It will continue to reveal the secrets that it obtains from Iran, and the IAEA, therefore, I believe, can be regarded as a spy agent. Such a body also gave the excuse for the strike against Iran under the pretext of Iran not cooperating enough or supposed violations, and we can expect sometimes that groups within the agency may even engage in suspicious activities, included suspected planting of materials contaminated within certain enrichment levels, after which Iran is then questioned over the matter. So the entire issue to me appears to be a part of a broader war on Iran, an effort to probe and limit its capabilities using the nuclear issue as the declared pretext for this campaign, whereas actually a war on Iran's overall capabilities.
All right, very nice opening take there. Thank you, Batul Subeti. And Leila Hatoum out of Beirut, welcome to the program. Thank you for your patience. Now, Leila, you're on. Okay, we know it's a shaky and fragile relationship between the IAEA and Tehran, one that flourished under the JCPOA with unprecedented access, a deal that Iran had no hand, we should mention, in ruining. Yet, here's the irony. Why is Rafael Grossi allowing that relationship be undermined today by the very parties that had a hand in ruining it?
Well, good evening to you, to your esteemed guests, and to the viewers as well. It's very interesting because we have discussed this in the past through your show as well. I mean, listen, Grossi in the past had accused Iran of hiding something. He issued a false statement at one point during and after what you call the Israeli aggression on Iran. And at the end of the day, when you look at the whole situation, I don't think that he was appointed to his post haphazardly. He didn't come because of merit or anything else. He was appointed to serve an agenda, as your own esteemed guest had pointed out. The IAEA works for the axis of evil, I'm going to call them, that's headed by the US, and that's basically working in favor of the Israeli entity. Okay? That's the first thing. The second thing you have to understand, Grossi, who had basically at one point or another demanded to access Iranian nuclear sites, even after the Israeli occupation had bombarded alongside the Americans Iran, he never did that with the Israelis, who are well known to have or to own the largest uranium related bombs in the region, nuclear bombs in the region. So at the end of the day, when I look at the situation, one, Grossi is actually appointed to spy on the states that the Americans and the Israelis want to spy on. Two, to ensure that everybody complies with the Western agenda. Three, everybody remains under control of the West. And four, and that's the most important thing, if you cannot destroy them or leak their information, then go and accuse them of something to put sanctions on them and then bring them about back to what you call subordinance.
Thank you, Leila. Batul, Iran's foreign minister Abbas Araghchi condemned the move, calling the resolution illegal and unjustified. He said the measure was adopted under pressure from these four countries, meaning the U.S. and the European Troika, France, the U.K., and Germany. He said despite opposition or abstentions from 15 board members. We have to ask, Batul, what and why? What objective do these four entities believe will result from this move, and why haven't other more constructive channels been utilized or entertained?
Right. So the issue is not related to Iran's nuclear intentions. I just think we need to be clear about that. Iran is still a member of the IAEA. Iran is still committed to its obligations under the NPT. The agency has not proven any violations or transgressions by Iran of its rights from the outset. It made claims, but those weren't substantiated. And we know that Iran was subject to the highest level of inspections that any state party to the NPT has undergone. So this tells us and it's obvious that the fear of Iran acquiring scientific capabilities that would enable it to defend itself is meant to leave Iran without real defenses. So ultimately, the goal is what? The goal is to get Iran to submit to the regional equations drawn by others, by the West, and for Iran to not interfere in ways that affects Western hegemony and interests. The goal is to keep the entire West Asia region open to Western intervention according to policies that serve Western strategies at the expense of the region's peoples. So the peoples of the region remain the consumers, unable to produce, unable to defend themselves against foreign aggression. Any voice that rises in the region, like Iran's voice or any voice of liberation resisting this Western authoritarian tendency, that must be suppressed. That is the Western goal. That is the core of the war on Iran, the nuclear file of which is used as a pretext. As for dealing with the European Troika in their decisions, they are merely following the American direction, becoming more rigid if America does, more lenient if America does. I believe they have no credibility, they have no independency or ability to make those independent decisions on matters that concern them unless approved by the American administration. But negotiating with them, to some extent, Iran has deemed necessary to avoid completely aborting that negotiation process. And all of this is an indication to us that the politics of power is working in the world. The world order is built on oppression and transgression. Even the terms and the institutions that the West itself creates, like the UN, for example, it did this to secure its own interests. And so when it comes to Iran, let's be clear, the IAEA is the transgressor. It has no proof against Iran, and it's accusing it in such a way.
Thank you. And Leila, same question, if I could put it to you. The reason for these continued efforts by the U.S. and the European Troika to undermine IAEA and Iran cooperation, and who does these damning reports benefit? You remember the one on non-compliance came the day before the Israeli regime's attacks on June 13th, and now this demand to force their way into sites that the U.S. bombed that week of mid-June.
Well, I'm going to start it with a question. Don't you find it very interesting that when the Americans said that they are sure that they hit what you call Iran's nuclear stockpile, and later on they tried to send the IAEA to double check, they weren't able to access those sites. Now what are they doing? They're trying to actually access those sites, and they're trying to bully Iran into it by issuing such statement and by issuing basically what you call a preliminary sanctioned kind of accusations. So when you look at the whole situation, you know that the Americans don't know for a fact if they actually hit that site or not. They want to access it to know how much damage they have basically inflicted against Iran, and they have no information. So they even lied to their people. Donald Trump lied to his people when he said, we destroyed their nuclear capability. They cannot basically stand on their 2 feet. If they actually are that sure, why are they trying to send the IAEA to go and inspect those sites? That's the first thing. The second thing, and that's very important, I'm going to add to what your esteemed guest had said. It's not only to ban countries from this region from having or acquiring power to defend themselves, because Iran had repeatedly said that it's not trying to create a nuclear bomb, so it's not going to use it for military, basically what you call uses. It's going to actually use it for the advancement of technology in the country to help its country develop better. The Americans and the Israelis, they don't want anybody developed. They want everybody to be subjugated to them through technology, among other things. And in that manner, I'll give you an example. I mean, forget Iran at one point. Let's take, for example, the U.S. own ally, Saudi Arabia, which has uranium in its own country, basically. They can actually mine for it. And the West, especially Europe and the U.S., were trying to pressure Saudi Arabia to actually send that uranium in raw material to Europe and to the U.S. so they can actually enrich it and work on it, and then send it back 10 times worth to the Saudis, who will have to pay for that price. And the Saudis said no. But we don't see the IAEA or anybody else basically intervening in that matter, despite the fact that this is basically uranium and the Saudis are going to look into having what you call peaceful nuclear power. They only do it to Iran. Why? Because Iran is the only one that says no to the West. And this is very important. When you actually hit Iran in this region, that's the last what you call a wall. I'm going to call it the China wall, in the face of the Western advancement towards taking over all of this region.
Thank you. Very nice input there. Batul, when there was a channel for dialogue, the indirect talks that were taking place pre-June aggression by the U.S. and the Israelis, why didn't the U.S. stick to those talks? Why didn't it return to the JCPOA Why did it abandon the JCPOA in the first place? And then the Europeans, they vowed if Iran stays committed post-May 18th of 2018, U.S. unilateral withdrawal under first term Donald Trump there, they vowed that they're going to try to make sure Iran receives concessions if it sticks to the parameters of the agreement. Iran did for a whole year and a few months, and it didn't get any of the relief that it was basically promised it. They failed at that. So why is the onus somehow on Iran and not them to have constructive cooperation and engagement?
In the same way that limiting Iran's, missile range to no more than 500 kilometers has nothing to do with the nuclear issue, with the West claiming that it's the nuclear file that is really the issue, then why would they bring in the missile issue? And we saw this even during the JCPOA, or Iran's political influence in the region, or Iran's relationship with the resistance movements in Palestine, Lebanon, Yemen. This tells us the crux of what all of these are about, whether it's the JCPOA and curbing Iran's ability to produce domestically, or if it's about launching a war in Iran. The nuclear issue is being exploited as a gateway to intervene in all these other areas to undermine Iran's nuclear direction, even though Iran, as we said, is committed to the IAEA's rules and laws, subject to its supervision, submits the required reports, and the agency conducts the required inspections. Iran is a party to the NPT. Yet this hostile behavior towards Iran uses Iran's very compliance as a pretext to cast out and to move towards the real issues. What is the real issues? The real issues is Iran's political role in the region. And of course, in these 2 years that we've seen, these 2 years of genocide, Israeli occupation entity has been given the complete free hand to draw out the maps, the quote-unquote new Middle East project plan, which Trump was 100% on board with. He himself in his election trail campaign spoke about Israel being too thin, it needs to fatten up essentially. And that's why they decided to strike front after front within the resistance axis. You know, so this was their chance to militarily strike Iran and to topple its government. And we know that this is a US interest before it's even an Israeli interest, because it's the US that is at the helm of leadership, and Israel cannot breathe without the American oxygen. So all of this goes back to the political role of Iran, encouraging regional forces to create their own security and to confront colonialist projects that are planted and relied on in this strange artificial Israeli occupation entity that was created in the region. And America has been using it as the foundation for their policies, with all the brutality associated with those policies and with the crimes committed. So the fundamental issue here is Western interests at its core.
And I often see, and I I'm going to have to skip a couple questions, because I'm glad that you touched on that, that it's all about the West's agenda for the region, Batul. And Leila, I want to put that to you. When asked, what more can Iran do at this point? Because it seems here, well, it will take to end the U.S. hostility toward the country. Obviously, the country, the U.S. wants not to have a peaceful nuclear program, not to enrich uranium, not to have missiles and drones for its own defense, or aerospace program for that matter, and no more support for Palestinians fighting apartheid, occupation, genocide, and ethnic cleansing, and other oppressed people in the region.
Well, you have to understand one thing. The West will never stop trying to bully Iran and everybody else that it thinks would pose a threat to its advancement and hegemony. At the end of the day, the only thing that Iran can do is stop playing as a gentleman with ethics, because no matter what Iran does, they will continue to accuse it of things until Iran totally caves in, or until they have their way by changing the governing body at the moment in Iran. So that's their ultimate goal. We've seen it. They've said it, not me. Donald Trump said it. The Israelis said it, among others. So having said that, what Iran needs to do is to continue advancing or pushing its technology towards further advancement, not wait for the West to tell it what it needs to do or what it has to do, and then file a lawsuit against the IAEA, or basically bring that matter to the United Nations, because the UN Charter actually says in Chapter 2, Article 2, Clause 7, it says that not a single state has the right to intervene in the internal affairs of a member state. The Americans are trying to do it through the IAEA, it's very evident. The European Union is trying to do it through the IAEA, and it's very evident. The Israelis are trying to do it through the IAEA, and it's very evident. So at the end of the day, what Iran can do is basically request the UN for help. And we know that the UN is basically a futile body to go to. But at the end of the day, they just like put it in their face. And then towards the end, you say, we tried our best. We gave you the reports, as Betul said. We have collaborated, as Betul said. And she mentioned, she extended it beautifully. And we've done everything that we can, including basically the Russians, who are members of the IAEA, who are taking care of some of the nuclear facilities in Iran. They came out and said there's no breaches. So towards the end, Iran will have to do one thing. Stand up and say, Khalas, that's it. We're cutting ties. They tried to do it earlier during this war, but I don't know why Iran resumed its basically what you call good ties with the IAEA if the IAEA is showing bad faith all the time. The good faith actor over here is Iran. It's not the IAEA. So what Iran can do, I mean, like, what's the worst that they can do? Like, put sanctions on Iran? They've done it. They've tried it for over a decade. They attacked it. I mean, what's next? So at the end of the day, Iran has the right to defend itself. It has the right to continue to advance its technology. It has the right to stop dealing with entities that are controlled by other nations who are trying to spy on Iran. You have the right to defend yourself in that matter. So, I mean, my opinion is basically to cut ties. But then again, I always go to what you call the harshest solutions. I know that Iran is all about diplomacy and talks and negotiations, but sometimes this doesn't work when you're dealing with a bully.
Really nice take there, Leila. Thank you. Betul, you can weigh in on this too. What more can Iran do at this point? It's been open to solutions, open to dialogue, open to talks with parties that have played one dirty game after another. And does the U.S. really think, Betul, it can bomb Iran's nuclear facilities and have Donald Trump parade around the planet bragging about it in front of cameras left and right, boast about it, and that Tehran will what, reciprocate those gestures with some kind of positivity?
Yes, I actually have the same take that Leila has, and that is what Iran shouldn't do, and that is to continue negotiating with the IAEA, because that is returning back to the same experience that Iran has tried and tested and been prey to, I believe, the deception of, you know, this deception that America won't strike us if we're in negotiations with the IAEA. You know, this was the case with the 12-day war. And deception can occur again. And, like, Israel can strike Iran when it decides to. And it's presumed that Iran, I hope, at any time that it negotiates, is taking into account that this is another deception and does its due diligence in all of this. Because even if new agreements relating to these inspections in the future are agreed, it remains that the IAEA is unreliable because matters are not in its hands. As we said, it moves according to the American directives. Now, on your question about Trump and the bombing campaign, I mean, look, Trump comes out and he says, we've destroyed, we've crushed, we've ended the Iranian nuclear project, and uses all these like victory-laden terms. But we know that there's really a message behind that, and that is one that contradicts reality and carries the taste of defeat. Trump doesn't want to hear anything about the Iranian nuclear file anymore. After Iran proved during the 12 days its military might and sent Netanyahu crying, asking for a ceasefire. And when Iran declares, so when Araghchi comes out and he declares, for example, that its nuclear facilities were significantly damaged, that too carries a kind of contradictory message, one that tastes like victory, as in, you cannot stop us moving forward. We have the pretext to do what suits our own interests. So I believe America's statements reflect incapacity, this recurring failure where major goals are set but not achieved. We saw this happen in Yemen when Trump declared he would unleash hell and end the Yemeni challenge in the Red Sea once and for all. Yet after 7 weeks, he declared victory himself without achieving any of his goals. So I believe after experiencing and discovering the true power balance on the ground, a new equation has been established now with Iran, and the threshold and the momentum required to start any new war has now risen, perhaps to a level where nuclear weapons would only be used in the most extreme madness of war under absolute desperation. And this new ceiling presents the West with new challenges. Either it acknowledges the new power balance on the ground, which has now been tested in a way that it's never been tested before due to those 12 days, because it was the first time in 40 years that Iran was at war, or America continues this hostile approach towards the Islamic Republic, which has also proven to be a failure after 45 years of sanctions that have backfired and produced this kind of resilience and strength despite a full and comprehensive embargo. So sanctions have failed, and what's left now is recognition and letting go of Western arrogance and superiority.
All right, thank you both for joining us on the program. Time has gotten the better of us. Stay safe to Betul Subeiti joining us from London, and Leila Hatoum joining us out of Beirut. And this brings us to the end of your Spotlight program. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except him, and he has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity,
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Salaam alaikum. This is Hussein, and you're listening to your program for humanity from IRIB English Radio. In this program, we talk about different Islamic teachings and Quranic elements pertaining to humanity and human beings. And in previous episodes, we started studying and covering a very good book in this regard titled A 250-Year-Old Person, which is a compilation of the sermons and lectures delivered by His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. In these sermons and lectures, he covers the life story and seerah, or biographies, of the Prophet of Islam, sallallahu alaihi wasallam, and the great leaders of Islam from his pure progeny. We were talking about the life of the Prophet of Islam in Medina. We talked about the external threats to early Muslim community in Medina. We talked about the pagans of Quraysh who attacked Muslims in Badr. And then we talked about how that resulted in another subsequent attack by pagans against Muslims in Uhud. There is this mountain called Uhud in the north of Medina. And pagans encountered, the army of pagans encountered army of Muslims there after an initial defeat of pagans against Muslims. Unfortunately, because of the disobedience of some of the Muslims, and because Quran says, وَفَشَلْتُمْ, you lost your courage and you left your positions, and that's why the enemy took advantage and attacked Muslims from the behind. And in that situation, chaotic situation, many good Muslims were martyred, including Hamza, the uncle of the Prophet of Islam, and some of those members of the army of Muslims, they were running away, escaping the battlefield. Quran says it's that tasaduna wala taluna ala ahadin. You were climbing the mountain and you would not even turn to see behind what's going on in the battlefield. And the Prophet was alone, except for some Muslims who remained and defended the Prophet. So it was a bad story and bad memory for Muslims, especially the martyrdom of Hamza affected the Prophet gravely, and also other Muslims who were martyred. And there was a lesson for Muslims to be taken from this, that if you disobey the leadership, if you do not abide by the laws or by the instructions given by the leader, unfortunately, defeats such as what we see in Uhud are very possible. Then, after Uhud, because of that situation, you could say that the pagans still had hope that we can have our final blow to this community, to this religion, but we need proper preparation. So you have the Battle of Confederates, or Ahzab, or Khandaq, the Battle of Trench. And the reason that is called the Battle of Trench is that in the fifth year after the migration, pagans, being very happy from the results of Uhud, they said, okay, now we should just go and finish these people. But for this, we need to take other tribes beside ourselves. Now, in this book, in his lecture, Ayatollah Khamenei says that people of Quraysh might not have been very expert in military techniques and tactics. That's why, because they were mainly good in business, and that's why they took aid from other tribes, and they create alliance against Muslims. That's why it's called confederates, ahzab. So they created a very big army, and they wanted to attack Muslims by surprise. But Muslims were informed beforehand, and they took in defensive position. Inshallah, we're going to cover that in the second segment after the break. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin al-Mustafa. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin al-Mustafa. Welcome back. This is Hussein, and you're listening to your program for humanity from IRIB English Radio. We were talking about the Battle of the Trench. We said it is called the Battle of the Trench because of the defense measure that Muslims took upon the instruction or suggestion by Salman the Persian, Salman Farsi, when the Prophet and the Muslim community in Medina were informed about the preparation of a great army by confederates who were coming towards Medina. And they had only 1 week to think how they want to encounter them. The numbers were very higher than Muslims. And they had in mind, the confederates, the pagans of Mecca, they had in mind that we go to Medina, we kill 100, 200 people, including the leadership and the people who are close to Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, and then Islam will be finished. So Muslims were informed of this, and the Prophet summoned a council of Muslims that what should we do? And Salman suggested that in situations like this, in our part, in Persia, we have a defense measure. We call it khandaq, which is coming from the root, old Persian root khandaq, which means something that you dig. So we dig a trench, like large trench and long trenches, that would stop the army from coming to our city. So Muslims started, and again, you have the leadership style of the Prophet, come and come, not go and go. The Prophet himself started digging the trench, and all other Muslims also participated in that. Ahead of everyone was the Prophet himself, who would spend times here and there helping Muslims and digging the trench. So after 1 week, they had a long trench dug around Medina. Actually, there are some natural barriers like the rocks and hilltops around Medina that would function as natural barriers, and Muslims did not have to dig trench there. They only had one space in the north of Medina that they had to dig a trench. And then when the Confederate army arrived there, and it was winter, actually, so they were stopped. They could not do anything. And they spent, I think, 2 weeks there, including a week of digging the trench. It lasted for Muslims for 3 weeks. After 2 weeks being there, the Confederate army could not do anything, and they went back. That is the short version of the story. And there the Prophet said that this was the last time that they tried to attack us. And from now on, this will be our time to take active steps, not in the form of offensive attacks, But active steps, inshallah, we're going to cover them in the next episode, how the Prophet step by step started to get close and establish their ground further and further by having the Umrah al-Qadha and then the Fatah, the triumphant return to Mecca without any bloodshed and in a peaceful way. Thank you very much for listening. Inshallah, next episode, we're going to cover those later years of the life of the Prophet in Medina and leading to the Fatah, triumphant return to Mecca. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
It's all I ever wish for. This life is not eternal, but the next will last forever.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
As the US closes door, China is opening new ones and redefining Africa's place in the world. There is talk of the continent turning Trump's punitive tariffs into a new opportunity. Now, will Africa rise to reshape its destiny, or will it be left behind in the global power struggle? And joining us today to discuss this important topic is Ireti Bakara Yusuf. Now, she is a broadcast journalist and founder of African Journalists Against Genocide. Also with us today is Zizwe Chiguka. Now, he is the organizer for the All African People's Revolutionary Party and the African Party for the Independence of Guinea and Cape Verde. Join us for this week's edition of Africa Today as we discuss how African countries can turn Trump's punitive tariffs into an opportunity. when the United States raised tariffs on African exports to as high as 30% in the case of South Africa, shockwaves rippled across the continent. Overnight, billions in trade were at risk. Uganda, Gabon, and Niger had already lost their duty-free access under a U.S. program known as the African Growth and Opportunity Act. For many, it felt like punishment, but for Africa, it could be a wake-up call. Because while Washington is shutting doors, Beijing is opening them. By 2024, Africa-China trade had surged past $295 billion. In just the first 5 months of 2025, it added another $134 billion. Factories, ports, and railways financed by China are changing the way Africa connects with the world. At the same time, African nations are rethinking their own future. The African Continental Free Trade Area is laying the foundations for the world's largest single market. Across the continent, a new spirit of self-reliance is taking hold. Now, these tariffs aren't just about economics. They are moves in a global power struggle over currency, over alliances, over the future of trade itself. Now, the question is, will Africa turn exclusion into power and claim its place in the new multipolar world order?
Trump's tariffs, Africa's opportunity.
South African President Cyril Ramaphosa recently addressed a virtual BRICS leaders' extraordinary summit that focused on the current economic environment and the state of the multilateral system. Now, commenting on the tariffs for imposed by the U.S., he said that we are witnessing seismic shifts in global trade that present both challenges and opportunities. Let's take a listen.
We are witnessing seismic shifts in global trade that present both challenges as well as opportunities in the reordering of the global economy. There is a shift from a unipolar to a multipolar world. This moment is marked by intensifying global competition and growing geopolitical tensions. Unilateral tariff actions are contributing to an increasingly protectionist environment, which poses great hardships and danger for the countries of the Global South. The uncertainty of the new trading regime has already negatively affected employment levels in my own country, South Africa, and is an obstacle to our economic growth. We are therefore supportive of meaningful BRICS initiatives that improve the resilience of our economies as BRICS countries.
Well, the South African president, they are speaking of new opportunities for Africa amid the trade war imposed by the U.S. president on Africa. Now, let's start off with Irete Bakare Yusuf. Given the recent discussions surrounding the tariffs imposed on African exports by the U.S., do you believe Africa should view these as an opportunity to reduce its reliance on Western markets?
I think it's important that Africa begins to actually take control and steer and sort of pull away more and more from its dependency on Western markets. Why is that? Because Africa needs to realize the only way that Africa can grow is to continue or begin to do more and more business with the within themselves, within Africa, across the region, and, you know, pull away from the powers that the Western region had over Africa. Indeed, the only way we can actually begin to see a growth, and if you like, a Viva Africa, and a fully independent Africa, an Africa that works for Africans, and indeed her massive youth, is to actually continue to do business.
Thank you. Now, let's bring in Zizwe Chiguka. Do you think Africa's ongoing efforts to reduce reliance on the U.S. through initiatives like the African Continental Free Trade Area will help shield the continent from the impacts of a U.S. trade war?
The Africa Free Trade Agreement will definitely help to buffer the African nation states against the tariff policies of the current U.S. administration, basically because Africa is the richest continent on Earth. And the economies of Africa, they need to be integrated so that they're not so dependent on foreign direct investment or foreign markets. many of the nation states in Africa are dependent upon U.S. foreign market for sales. But if we integrate the economies of Africa, and the African Free Trade Agreement is a step in that direction, we will become less dependent upon the U.S. economy as a foreign market.
President Donald Trump's aggressive tariff policies, particularly the imposition of reciprocal tariffs of up to 50% on imports from countries with trade surpluses with the U.S., have significantly disrupted global trade dynamics. African nations heavily reliant on U.S. markets for exports like textiles, agriculture, and minerals have been among the most affected. In response, many are actively seeking new markets across Asia to mitigate the adverse economic impacts.
President Trump's recent decision to exempt key African minerals like gold, tungsten, uranium, and graphite from U.S. tariffs has raised questions about the underlying motives of these trade policies. Now, the administration justifies these exemptions as necessary to secure critical supply chains vital for sectors like aerospace, electronics, and energy. Now, Mr. Chiguka, how do you interpret this move?
The Trump administration could not put tariffs on those rare earth minerals because of the need for those rare earth minerals. It's the same thing in Africa. There are certain things, mineral resources, like uranium, coltan, et cetera. The administration in the U.S. cannot afford to put tariffs on those kinds of things because of the need. So they take people as fools, basically, when they have these economic arrangements and negotiations with other countries. And it's also a result of colonialism in the past in Africa that the U.S. government is able to bully people in Africa, the governments in Africa, in terms of making these arrangements to the detriment of the economy of the African nation states. So unification is the key. The integration of the African economy will stop all of those problems that the colonialists and imperialists are trying to impose on the African nation states.
Thanks for that, Mr. Chiguka. Let's now take a short break before we continue our discussion on punitive U.S. tariffs on Africa and how they can be turned into an opportunity for the continent. Stay with us.
Trump's tariffs, Africa's opportunity.
The African Continental Free Trade Area stands as a cornerstone of Africa's development vision under Agenda 2063. Now, a unified market holds immense potential, unlocking boundless opportunities for the continent's growth and prosperity. The Secretary General of this Pan-African body elaborates on the opportunities.
By the year 2035, the AFCFTA market, the combined GDP of the AFCFTA market is estimated to be close to $7 trillion United States dollars. That means that there are opportunities for small medium enterprises, for young entrepreneurs to export across regions of the African continent and to take advantage of this vast market. However, if we don't have an integrated single market, we will not be able to achieve the positive projections that many around the world have made about the potential of the AFCFTA.
Well, as Africa continues to develop its economic strategies, initiatives like the African Continental Free Trade Area are undermining the U.S. Multilateral trade frameworks with Africa, such as the so-called African Growth and Opportunity Act, or AGOA. This is seen by many as presenting an opportunity for Africa to push for stronger economic integration within the continent itself. Ms. Bakare Yusuf, what are your thoughts on this?
Absolutely, it does. I mean, AGOA really, yes, Nigeria, my country, was one of the largest users, if not the largest users of AGOA, but, you know, that no longer exists. And again, AGOA was just a way of, you know, it was the American soft power way of controlling African countries. So certainly we should get away. And I can't say, I can honestly say for myself, I am one of those who sees this as a great, great opportunity for Africa to free itself of the American stronghold. But the question is Africa ready? They need our resources. The same President Trump that's imposing tariffs on South Africa, on Nigeria, etc., that's weaponizing tariffs, is actually, they need the rare earth. He's talking about, oh, I'm stopping the war in Congo, you know, in exchange for natural resources. Well, he hasn't even stopped any war, but I have no doubt he's probably signed the natural resource on how to steal from Congo, how to steal from Sudan, how to steal from Nigeria. Heck, how to steal from as many parts of Africa as possible. And those are the things that we need to stop from happening. If African countries had led the initiative and ensured that the war in Congo, the genocide going on, is actually stopped and they're able to get there and stop it, talk to their brother leaders, put a stop to it, then we wouldn't have had a President Trump who would be able to interlude and claim that he stopped a war, which he hasn't stopped. I must keep saying that. He hasn't stopped. What he did was to sign a contract to collect more minerals, to steal, not collect, to actually thieve and steal more minerals from Africa in the future, in order to tell to do a ceasefire that only lasted a few days.
The exclusion of African countries from AGOA presents a significant new opportunity for the continent to reconsider and potentially break free from trade agreements that may have restricted its long-term growth and potential. Now, Mr. Chibuka, how has AGOA's narrow focus on specific industries and reliance on external partners hindered the continent's ability to diversify its economies and pursue more self-sustaining models of development?
Definitely think that this is an opportunity for Africa to unify economically, politically, socially. On the economic front, the African Growth and Opportunities Act was a thing that was used by the imperialist powers to keep a dependency relationship of these newly independent African states. So this would work in our favor to spark a change in Africa to further integrate the African economy. And so the U.S. administration is helping to mobilize our people for greater forms, levels of unity on the economic front. So it's a good thing. It's a good thing that they are actually trying to impose these tariffs. So now we can integrate our economies and be less dependent on the African Growth and Opportunities Act, which is to the disfavor of the African nation states anyway.
China's expanding influence in Africa represents a significant shift from the historically exploitative engagement of Western powers, particularly the United States. Many analysts view the increasing trade between China and African nations as a constructive alternative to the punitive tariffs often associated with U.S. economic policy.
There's a China-Africa summit every year in which the Chinese forgive the debt of many African nation states. And also China has helped to build infrastructure projects throughout Africa, such as the Trans-Am Railroad back in the 70s. So that relationship with China has always been a positive and is increasingly becoming even better with their help financially and economically, so that we are less dependent upon the U.S. and the European imperialists that charge astronomical interest rates on these loans that they give us. Because if you look at all the nation states in Africa that have taken out International Monetary Fund loans, they're still paying the interest and they can't even get to the principal. So therefore, the indebtedness of African nation states to IMF is continuing to rise, whereas China is helping and forgives many of the loans so that we can become less dependent on the International Monetary Fund in Africa.
In response to the U.S.'s aggressive trade policy, there is a growing argument for African countries to focus on de-dollarization and create more independent trade structures within the Global South. Now, Mr. Chibuka, how can de-dollarization and the establishment of independent trade structures help African countries mitigate the impact of external economic pressures such as an aggressive trade policy from the U.S.?
Therefore, it is incumbent upon Africa to take this opportunity to break away from the U.S. dollar. The U.S. dollar was the reserve currency and is steadily declining in terms of nation states that are dependent on the U.S. dollar. So this is an opportunity for Africa to become less dependent and use the mechanism of de-dollarization through the BRICS Alliance and other mechanisms, so that when the U.S. dollar declines, finally, it won't affect Africa as much. It won't be as disruptive, because the handwriting is on the wall for the U.S. dollar. It is declining on a global scale, and the African nations have to be able to adjust, or they will go down if they keep dependency on the U.S. dollar. Therefore, de-dollarization is a must in Africa.
South Africa has been hit hard by the Trump tariffs. The ANC-led coalition government has struggled to respond effectively, while some critics argue that South Africa's response lacked urgency or forcefulness, especially given the economic stakes. Pretoria has clearly taken diplomatic and strategic steps.
Ms. Bakare Yusuf will have the last word today. Now, what steps should African governments take to ensure that they are better prepared for such economic shocks in future?
We wait, like I said earlier, we wait on until the problem lands in our country, slaps us in the face before we start to respond. Why isn't there anybody looking to the future and planning? That is what African countries must do. African leaders must start to look, visionize a really strong and independent Africa, and continue to plan, not just plan, implement, not just implement, create the structure, the framework, the foundation to build that vision on. But you can't do that again if you don't invest in your education. So now we come to social structure. You've got to invest in your education, because you have to be ready to pass on the baton to the next generation. Yet again, we've got the likes of Paul Biya, who are wanting to run again and again and again. So the youth, of course, they feel despondent. They're in despair. They don't see a future.
Well, there you have it. Africa needs to have visionary leaders and invest in education for the continent to be free of manipulation by the likes of Trump. I'd like to thank our guests today, Irete Bakare Yusuf and Zizwe Chibuka, for their incisive analysis. Now let's proceed to the next part of our program, honoring Africa's remarkable civilizations, which are the cornerstone of its vibrant cultural legacy. In today's fast-evolving world, it's increasingly important for young Africans to reconnect with their heritage. Now, preserving this identity is key to shaping a confident and empowered future. My colleague, Janet Ali, will share more on this.
Hello, I'm Janet Ali, and welcome to a series of programs that will delve into some of the ancient African civilizations. As Africa moves to become a focal point of the world's economy, reflecting on the continent's rich civilization is critical to preserve its pure identity. Today, let us get to know more about the Songhai civilization. Thank you.
empire, one of the largest and most powerful civilizations in West African history. This civilization emerged in the 15th century and was centered around the Niger River. The empire's capital was the city of Gao, but it's also included other significant cities like Timbuktu and Djenne. The rise of the Songhai Empire began under the leadership of Sunni Ali in the 1460s. Sunni Ali expanded the empire's territories through military conquests and established control over crucial trade routes. His successor, Askia Muhammad, further centralized the administration, promoting Islam and implementing a legal system based on Islamic law. Under Askia Muhammad's rule, the empire experienced a golden age marked by political stability, economic prosperity, and cultural flourishing. The Songhai Empire's achievements were numerous. Timbuktu and Djenne became renowned centers of learning, attracting scholars and students from across the Islamic world. The empire's wealth was built on trans-Saharan trade, dealing in gold, salt, and other valuable commodities. The Songhai military was also formidable, utilizing cavalry and riverine forces to maintain control over their vast territories. However, the decline of the Songhai Empire began in the late 16th century. Internal strife and succession disputes weakened the central authority. In 1591, the Moroccan army invaded the Songhai Empire equipped with firearms, which gave them a significant advantage over the Songhai forces. The Battle of Tondibi marked the end of Songhai dominance, and the empire gradually fragmented into smaller states. Despite its decline, the legacy of Songhai civilization still endures. Efforts to preserve the heritage of the Songhai include protecting historical sites like the Sankore Madrasa in Timbuktu, a UNESCO World Heritage Site. Timbuktu's ancient manuscripts, which contain invaluable knowledge on various subjects, are being digitized and preserved to safeguard the cultural and intellectual achievements of the Songhai era. That was a brief description of the Songhai civilization. From me, Jannat Ali, it's goodbye for now.
Well, and that brings us to the end of this week's edition of Africa Today. It's always great having you. On behalf of the entire crew, it's me, Mubarak Kenya, saying goodbye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Greetings, dear listeners. This is Iran Radio from Tehran, the beautiful capital of the Islamic Republic of Iran. In Islam, the ink of the scholar is more holy than the blood of the martyr. There are an estimated 1.8 billion Muslims in the world, which is about 1.5% of the world's population. Due to the birth and conversion rates, Islam is considered to be the fastest growing religion in the world today. And here's what's awaiting you on your radio station. Don't miss a beat.